The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, hi everyone. War, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay. All right, you guys are on the right side of this question. That's good. So the violence and trauma of war is an intrinsic part of life, daily life, for millions of people around the globe. So why should we actually care about the subject of this talk, which is artists who use their work to take a stand against war? During the lead up to the Iraq War in 2002, the historian Howard Zinn explained that art can help us see through the staggering statistics to grasp the human toll of war. He wrote, and this was in the Progressive, quote, "Individual human beings are missing in the numbers. It is left to the poets and novelists to take us by the shoulders and shake us and ask us to look and listen. Should we not ask everyone to imagine what war will do to the human beings whose faces will not be known to us, whose names will not appear except on some future war memorial? For this, we will need the help of people in the arts, those who through time, from Euripides to Bob Dylan, have written and sung about specific, recognizable victims of war." So I'm basically going to ground this talk on what Zinn's arguing here, that art can help inspire a visceral, gut-level opposition to war, that in the context of a fighting anti-war movement can move larger numbers of people into action. So before I get into it, I just have a few disclaimers. So first, my plan today is to take you through a breakneck tour of anti-war art over the last 100 years. But given that I can't go through the specific history of every war or every significant piece of art made during these time periods, so trust me that I'm going to leave out a ton and that you're going to have to fill in the gaping holes in the discussion. Second, I am sticking today to visual art only because that's what I'm familiar with, which means I'm not going to talk about music, poetry, literature, or film, although those artistic forms have played an incredibly significant role in the history of anti-war resistance, whether it's All Quiet on the Western Front or the Battle of Algiers, but I won't be talking about that stuff. And third, I just wanted to say that I tried really hard in researching this talk to provide representation to artists across gender, race, and nationality, but I had to rely on art history sources that are not nearly inclusive enough, and it just suggests that there's so much more work that needs to be done. Okay, so getting started, this is Guernica by Pablo Picasso. This is arguably the most famous and influential anti-war painting of all time. Picasso's masterpiece depicts the atrocity that took place on April 26, 1937, during the Spanish Civil War, when Nazi German aircraft obliterated the Basque town of Guernica in Spain. Thousands of civilians were killed on that day, mostly women and children. And the shock and power of this painting helped bring worldwide attention to the cause of the Spanish Republic against the fascist army of General Franco. But this work has also been a touchstone for activists in subsequent generations. And I think it's worth asking what makes this painting so effective. I mean, the work itself is a mural, it's black and white and gray. It's painted in a style that one art critic called, quote, "Cubist apocalypse." Meaning you've got everything that took place or that he's trying to portray stripped down to its bare essentials of shape and form. And I think Picasso's filled this painting with allegorical symbols that people have spent a lot of time interpreting, from the light bulb at the top, you know, eye at the top, to the bull and the horse. And I think it's this style that allows Picasso to pull off two things simultaneously. On the one hand, the painting is about a specific historical event. It's a witness and a testament to that event. But at the same time, it projects a more general vision about total war against civilians. And it was made during a time in the 1930s when the victims of war were shifting dramatically from professional soldiers to civilians. In the First World War, only 5% of those who died in the war were civilians. By World War II, it was 66%. The estimate today is that the casualties of wars are 80 to 90% civilians. And I think that's why the imagery of Guernica has continued to resonate with activists down through the decades, because it's really about every war. So in the 1960s, this was a poster that was carried in demonstrations. Whoa, that's out of order. Sorry, what happened to my, All right, I lost a couple things. This was a poster that was carried in demonstrations during the 1960s. In a more recent era, I don't know if people remember when in 2003, when Colin Powell went to the UN Security Council to drum up support for the Iraq War. But in the Security Council, there's a tapestry version of Guernica, and the UN officials decided they had to cover it up so it wasn't the background to his speech drumming up support for the war. And as Maureen Dowd wrote in 2003 in the New York Times, quote, "Mr. Powell can't very well seduce the world into bombing Iraq, surrounded on camera by shrieking and mutilated women, men, children, bulls, and horses." And so I think that is the continued power of this piece. This is a work that was made 2 years ago by a Bulgarian artist, Yavko Savov, and it's about the refugees in the Mediterranean who continue to this day to drown trying to get to safety. Okay, so from here on in, I've organized this talk chronologically. So I'm going to take us through the art of World War I, World War II, the atomic era and the Cold War, the Vietnam War, the struggle for Palestine, and the War on Terror. So I'm going to do all of that in 35 minutes. Okay, so ready? Okay, World War I. The First World War began in 1914. 4 years later, 17 million were dead in the trench warfare of Europe, and another 41 million were wounded. Empires had fallen, and revolution was raging in Russia and Germany. This was a war that was so dislocating and so traumatic and so different than anything that had come before it that artists felt they had to completely reinvent the language of art to even express the experience of this war. So Marcel Duchamp made this piece, it's called Fountain, in 1917, and it is, as you can see, it's a urinal that he signed R. Mutt. And it's hard to kind of believe, but this urinal is one of the most important foundational works of modern art, because it launched the idea that art can be made from found objects, that the meaning of a work is separate from the form of the work, and a whole bunch of other things. And it's often, when we learn about this in art history class, it's often talked about as in terms of the art history movements that followed from Duchamp's experiments with ready-mades. But I want to look at this as an expression of Duchamp's experience with war, and that this is actually him saying, you know, what is his point here? That Western civilization is nothing to be proud of and nothing to be excited about. It's actually something that should be pissed on. And he wanted to put this in a museum at the heart of Western culture and say, you know, so much for your so-called civilization. And I think, you know, it really, he forces us really to question what does it mean to have art and craftsmanship and beauty and culture in a world that's sending millions of young people to die in trenches. Duchamp was actually spent the war in New York City, but there were artists in Europe who were directly experiencing that war and were making work about their experience. So this is the great artist Kathy Kollowitz. She's associated with the art movement called German Expressionism. And even before the war, she was committed to making images about the struggles of working class people. And then her only son was killed in the war. And her pictures become all about the grief that working class women and children were forced to endure. But she didn't just grieve. The death of her son forced her to join the socialist movement in Berlin, and she participated in the events of the 1918 German Revolution, which is how she came to make this image for the funeral of Karl Liebknecht, the German revolutionary who was murdered alongside Rosa Luxemburg. And so this is called Memorial for Liebknecht from 1920. The war also turned George Grosz, another artist, into a revolutionary Marxist. He was arrested in 1919 for participating in the Spartacist uprising, led by Luxemburg and Liebknecht. And his paintings of Germany during World War I are full of rage and cynicism at a bourgeoisie that was partying amidst the wreckage of war. So you see, this is called Pillars of Society, and you've got the priest at the top and the guy with the teacup on his head and the other guy with his brain spilling out. This one at the top is called Swamp Flowers of Capitalism, and the one below is called Sunny Land. And this one, Pimps of Death. So you have the general talking to the capitalists while the skeletons and the ghosts of the war are stalking the streets of Berlin. Otto Dix was like a lot of young men. He embraced the war when it first broke out. He volunteered for the German army and ran a machine gun unit in the Battle of the Somme. And he was wounded very severely in that battle. And that experience in combat turned him against the war and against capitalism. And he created these horrifying images of what trench warfare was like for rank and file soldiers. He also made this piece, We Want Bread, where you can see the rich are having a party, and then outside the window, workers are marching by demanding bread. And this painting, The Trench, about his experience in trench warfare, doesn't exist anymore. It was destroyed by the Nazis, who condemned him as a degenerate artist. Okay, I'm gonna jump forward in time now, in time and place, to 1946. And from Europe to the United States. People may know the painter Jacob Lawrence, and he's famous for doing an incredible series of paintings about the black migration in the US. But in researching this talk, I discovered this 14-panel series that he did called the War Series that talks about the black American experience during the so-called Good War. I had never seen these paintings until I found them. Lawrence actually served in a segregated unit of the US Coast Guard during World War II. He was recruited by the military to become a wartime artist, and he went on to document battles in Italy and Egypt and India. He made this series just a year after the war ended. So I think victory shows sort of the ambivalence of the black soldier fighting for a war for democracy, for a country that still practiced legal apartheid. For black people, there's something about that hunch that to me really has that sense of ambivalence and the ironic title. This is the letter about what it feels like to receive a letter that your loved one has been killed in war. This is called Prayer. And this one is called Beachhead. And it takes us right into the chaos of the battlefield. The figure of the black soldier with his hands outstretched in kind of a Christ-like position, I think may be a reference to Francisco Goya's famous anti-war piece, The Third of May, which that positioning appears in a lot of different work. So World War II ended with the US dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and destroying those cities and opening up the era of nuclear proliferation. In 1974, and there's a great extent to which that horrific crime and that atrocity has never really been understood, I think, in this country for what it was, the war crime that it was. In 1974, the Japan Broadcasting Company started gathering paintings and drawings from people who had lived through the atomic bombings as children. And they built a collection of them, and they were exhibited in Hiroshima in 1975. And I just want to show some examples of them. They're incredibly short arms. Okay, they're incredibly powerful. So the name of the artist is at the bottom, and I don't know very much about these artists. This artist, Akiko Takakura, wrote about this drawing. He explained, black rain, huge drops. The ones still living crane their faces to the sky and open their mouths wide to catch the drops. Hot bodies, so very hot, like balls of fire, they wanted water. So So I think the power of these drawings is their immediacy and the fact that these are people, artists who directly witness these things, and we're trying to transfer them, those experiences, to paper. But I think it's the impact of the atomic bomb and the U.S. occupation of Japan cut through Japanese visual culture and influenced Japanese visual culture for decades in a lot of different ways. So in the 1950s, a couple years ago, there was an exhibit in Chicago of a group of painters from Japan called the Gutai Group, who were active in the 50s and 60s. And these were artists who were very influenced by abstract expressionism, which in the 50s was reaching its high point in New York. But they were using the language of abstract art, I think, in a way that I think really captures the sort of violence and deep sense of trauma that this generation had been through. So they took the concept of action painting to a new level. They performed actions on the canvas of things like smashing glass bottles, shooting the canvas with bullets, using thick red gushing paint to evoke blood and guts and fire. And I think even in New York School abstract expressionism, there's an element of the nuclear age that to me it really permeates a lot of the work. So this is a painting by Jackson Pollock called Shimmering Substance, which is sometimes people say is about his experience of nature. But when I read about what he said about this painting, I think there's also an element where it's really an image of light and energy and kind of a radioactive quality that you can't separate out from the time that it's made. So Pollock actually said, quote, "New needs need new techniques. The modern painter cannot express this age, the airplane, the atom bomb, the radio, in the old forms of the Renaissance or of any other past culture." Now, artists all over the world, not just who directly experienced the nuclear horror, but artists around the world in the 40s and 50s were trying to articulate and get the word out about the madness of nuclear war and the arms race. And in the US, artists of the left who in the 1930s had painted some of the most enduring images that we have of class struggle in the US, those guys were still on the scene in the 40s and 50s, and they start turning their attention, many of them start turning their attention and their tools to the issue of a world without nuclear weapons. So these are two socialist realist artists who did work in the 40s, Boris Deutsch, "What Atomic War Will Do to You." And this is Philip Evergood, who's well known for his paintings of minor strikes and class struggle in the 30s, who did this painting about a nuclear war. The socialist artist Ben Shahn was haunted by a series of events that took place in March 1954, when the US ran thermonuclear tests in the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. The nuclear fallout from that test rained down on islanders and spread radiation sickness and cancer. One small Japanese fishing vessel called the Lucky Dragon No. 5 got caught in the hailstorm of radioactive material and became a symbol of this horrific, crazy test. And Ben Shahn would go on to make dozens of paintings and drawings about the fate of the Lucky Dragon. He thought about it for the rest of his life. In this one, this is the fisherman, one of the fishermen in the boat, and he's holding up something that says, "I am a fisherman, Akiki Kubayama by name. On the 1st of March, 1954, our fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon, wandered under an atomic cloud 80 miles from Bikini. I and my friends were burned. We did not know what happened to us. On September 23rd of that year, I died of atomic burn." And this is Sean's painting from 1960, is also titled, "We Did Not Know What Happened to Us." Okay, moving on now to the Vietnam era. Sorry to do 100 years of history. Okay, so the American war in Vietnam lasted from 1965 to 1974. And by the time the US lost the war, around 3 million Vietnamese and 55,000 US soldiers lost their lives. The 60s and 70s saw an explosion of anti-war artwork that merged with anti-war organizing. And taking inspiration from the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, artists began to organize in collectives and make collaborative works of art. So I want to touch on three examples of this. One is the Peace Tower, the second is the Art Workers Coalition, and the third is the fight for artistic and political free speech. So in January 1966, a group of artists led by Irving Petlin and Mark DeSuvero put up a billboard on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles that said, "Stop the War in Vietnam, Artist Protest Tower to be erected here." So vandals came and knocked down the sign, and the artists put it back up. And then the vandals knocked down the sign again, and it went on for months. Finally, the artists constructed this 58-foot tall steel tetrahedron, which displayed 418 works of art, some by really famous artists of the day, and all of the works were on an anti-war theme. This is what the LA Times said, quote, at the time, quote, "Night after night, would-be saboteurs came hoping to destroy the Tower of Protest, some of them active duty soldiers and Marines from nearby military bases. And night after night, the artists defended the structure and the anti-war art that surrounded it with their own security patrols." In 2006, that I've done or that I have left? Done. Okay, thanks, perfect. In 2006, the Peace Tower was rebuilt as a protest against the Iraq War at the Whitney Museum. And so that's it on the right. The second collaborative effort that I want to talk about is what's happening in New York City. A group of artists who opposed the war joined forces and launched the Art Workers Coalition, the AWC. And the AWC created this, which is probably the most iconic poster of the Vietnam War era. It was based on a photograph of the 1968 My Lai massacre, in which US troops slaughtered an entire village of unarmed Vietnamese civilians. The title of this piece, "And Babies," came from a transcript of a Mike Wallace 60 Minutes interview with the soldier Paul Medlow, who participated in the massacre. And so the Mike Wallace said, "And you killed how many at that time?" And Medlow said, "Well, I fired them automatic, so you can't, you just spray the area on them, so you can't know how many you killed because they were going so fast. So I might have killed 10 or 15 of them. Question, men, women, and children? Answer, men, women, and children. Question, and babies? Answer, and babies." And so this, the Art Workers Coalition created this piece. And it might have just become another graphic image. The Museum of Modern Art said they would fund the production of it. And it might have just sort of gone on like that. But the two members of MoMA's Board of Trustees, Nelson Rockefeller and William S. Paley, who was the head of CBS, were firm supporters of the war and backed Nixon. And when they found out that MoMA was talking about printing this, they hit the roof and they absolutely said not. But New York City's union stepped in to save the day. The New York City Lithographers Union printed 50,000 copies of these posters, and it was distributed all over the world. So in further protest of MoMA's decision to pull out of this project, AWC protesters stormed MoMA and unfurled copies of the poster in front of Picasso's Guernica painting, which was on loan to MoMA at the time. And this is an image of that protest, drawing that connection. The third kind of collective artistic protest during the Vietnam War that I think is very important and not well known enough about was the fighting for the space for free speech. So during the Vietnam era, activists and artists found all kinds of creative ways to desecrate the flag. And some people were prosecuted for it because it wasn't actually until 1989 that the Supreme Court ruled that flag desecration was a protected form of speech. So people actually went to jail over this. So in 1970, three artists, Faith Ringgold, John Hendricks, and Jean Toche, sought a way to challenge the laws against flag desecration and oppose the war. So they took out an ad in the New York Times and they called for a people's flag show that anyone could submit to so long as it was flag desecration artwork that they were submitting. And they actually held an opening of all of this work at the Judson Memorial Church in Washington Square Park in November 1970. And the poster that advertised the show read, quote, "A flag that does not belong to the people to do with as they see fit should be burned and forgotten." And I want to say something about Faith Ringgold, because I'm a textile artist, and I've known about her work for a long time because she's one of the great story quilt artists in the U.S., but I didn't know until preparing this talk that she created all this work in the 60s that was radically anti-racist and anti-war, and it was thrilling to discover that she had this history. So this was her contribution to the show. Flag for the moon, die, and then N-word. And basically, if you turn that flag sideways, you can see that in the stars it says die, and then the N-word is in the stripes. And what she's clearly saying is that nationalism and racism are deeply American and go hand in hand. Now the US government, they went and they arrested the three organizers of the show. So Ringgold, Hendricks, and Tosh, even though they were defended by the ACLU, they were all found guilty for having this show, and they were sentenced to 30 days in prison and fines. And the American flag has continued to be a source of political symbolism, especially for black artists. I had to throw in this incredible piece from 2010 by one of my favorite artists, a former metal worker, named Thornton Dial, and he made this flag out of paint, bones, and found doll parts on wood. So he's saying a lot in that piece about America. And I think as Ringgold's work shows, the artists in the Vietnam era were influenced by all the powerful social movements that were gripping American society, not just the anti-war movement, but the civil rights and black power and the feminist movement. And some feminist artists began making work that directly tied responsibility for the war to male gender roles and women's oppression. So in this one, Judith Bernstein, the fun gun, is literally glued bullets to this drawing. So it's pretty clear she's talking about that masculinity is in some way the problem and is related to the war. The feminist artist Mae Stevens made a whole series of paintings, all with the title Big Daddy, where she painted this war general, and it's actually the portrait of her own father who was abusive to her. And in doing so, she was trying to show a connection between our personal and political abuse of power and the ways that those are connected. So I want to look now at the debates among artists about how the Vietnam War is memorialized and who are its victims and how should we tell those stories. So most of you have probably visited the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. It's a really political and emotional experience, and it's a piece that flies in the face of war memorials that celebrate the nobility of war and the nobility of dying in war. It's very different than war memorials that we're used to. So I think it's a very important piece. The artist Chris Burden felt that there was really a missing dimension in Maya Lin's memorial, and so his response was to create a work called The Other Vietnam Memorial. It's etched copper plates, they stand 13 feet high, and they're etched with the names of 3 million Vietnamese. This piece is actually in Chicago at the MCA. So people said to him, well, how did you find 3 million names of people who died in the war? Because the US didn't keep lists of who they killed, as they still don't keep lists of who they killed. So what Chris Burden did was he used a computer and the Vietnamese phone book, to generate the 3 million names. And he got a lot of criticism for that, that the names weren't real, and that was actually exactly his point, that nobody knows the names because this, as I said, the government doesn't keep track of the sort of the people who suffer from its wars. And I think there's a further criticism of Burden's work that I think is, to me, we can talk about it in debate, but that the fact that he's not Vietnamese means he's still speaking on behalf of people and not, so I looked for monuments in Vietnam to memorialize the war, and I couldn't find any, and I'm sure they're there, I just couldn't find them. So I decided that I wanted to end this section by, it is important to have the experiences of Vietnamese themselves when represented in this talk. So what I found is that the North Vietnamese Army, they were fighting a struggle for national liberation, and they sent trained artists to live with their soldiers during the war and to experience everything that the soldiers experienced and to do drawings and to capture that experience. So this work is not large-scale monuments because they made their drawings on little scraps of paper. They were living underground. They were bombed. There was napalm, and it had to be something that they could be portable. And still, I think this work's extremely beautiful. I think there's a real noble kind of face that this woman has in this piece that I think shows the sort of spirit of a national liberation struggle. And I just wanted to show a little bit more of this work. And these are fast drawings. A lot of them were destroyed. And this is just sort of what we have left. The artist, one of these artists, Quoc Phong, he explained, quote, "The soldiers would ask me to draw their portraits in case they died. It was a kind of historical evidence of them. They told me about their hopes and dreams while I drew them. They liked watching me draw. It made them feel calm. My purpose was not to shock the audience. I drew for the soldiers." Okay, so the last kind of work I want to talk about has been the work that's been made over the past 20 years, both in terms of the struggle for Palestine and as part of opposing the war on terror. And I don't know if there's been so much artwork, particularly in the Arab world, there's been such a rich explosion of art. And I don't have time to go through it, so I wanted to just touch on a couple of people who I think we should know these names. And I think this is Dia al-Azawi, and this is the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He's an Iraqi artist. He was living in Beirut. He made this paint. This is a series of drawings that he made, and it's a huge piece. And to give you a sense of that, this is him assembling it on the floor of his studio, and you can see it's made up of these smaller drawings that he put together. And this was the Sabra and Shatila massacre was a massacre that was instigated by the Israeli state in a refugee camp in southern Beirut, where more than between 2,000 and 3,000 Palestinian and Lebanese civilians lost their lives. Art Daily, this work was shown in 2012, and Art Daily wrote about it. A boot, two chairs, a plane, a USA missile, and barbed wire are interspersed between the ravaging expressionism of shaded forms and the darkened areas of nothingness that toss, eject, and dismember bodies until they are buried. It's a very powerful piece if you have time to look at it in more detail. For Palestinian artists, art is a way of asserting cultural survival against the genocidal project of the Israeli state. Mona Hatoum is an extremely important Palestinian artist who makes work about state control, racism, prisons, and what it means to have a war against an entire population like this crib that is also a prison. And this is another artist I just wanted people to know about, Khaled Hafez. This is another huge piece. He's Egyptian, and he's made art about the revolution and its aftermath. The last piece I want to talk about, there's been a lot of art against the Iraq War, a tremendous amount, posters, all kinds of art. This project really I found very moving, so I just wanted to end with this. This Iraq Veterans Against the War, two members of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Drew Cameron and Drew Matope, created the Combat Paper Project, where veterans shredded their uniforms and made paper pulp out of them, and then went around the country creating anti-war images on the paper that they made, or images about the trauma and the experience of war. So they took this on the road, and they've been working with veterans around the country to shred their uniforms and make this work, You Are Not My Enemy. And it's actually veterans that going all the way back to World War II that have taken part in this process of shredding. So in some ways to me, just to wrap up, I think the most shocking thing when I was looking at all of this work, whether it's World War I or Vietnam or from today, is how current and relevant, I mean, even the work that's made in 1920 feels like it could be made about the Trump administration today. And I think that's because the fundamental reality of imperialism and war have not changed. you know, when they're set, these artists are satirizing the politicians who lie to get us into war, and the capitalists who profit from war, and the soldiers who rebel and turn against that war, those are still the processes that we are living with today. So I just want to leave you with two images about this continuity. This is a protest outside the Metropolitan Museum in New York that happened in 1970, the New York art strike against racism, war, and repression. And then I thought I'd end on, this is a photo I took last month at a 70th anniversary of the Nakba protest when we marched past the Art Institute of Chicago. And it really made me feel like, in some ways, the best way to understand art is to be part of the struggle for changing society and opposing the worst aspects of this society. So I'll end with that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.